Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for February the 3rd, 2020. This is Air Force veteran David Corey, along with my co-host, Richard Hurley. Thank you for joining us this evening. Hello, Richard.
Good evening, David, and good evening, everybody. Good evening, Ashley. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for February the 3rd, 2020. And I want to let everybody know that our special guest tonight is Ashley Lowry, the president and CEO of the Homeless Empowerment Program in Clearwater, Florida. But before she joins us in a moment, though, I want to remind everyone that this is a call-in show. We welcome your views and your comments and your questions, so you can call us at any time during the show at 1-888-627-6008. Again, the toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. Back to you, David.
Thanks. Let me introduce our special guest tonight. She's the president of an extraordinary organization devoted to helping people who find themselves homeless in Clearwater and Pinellas County, Florida. Ashley Lowry has led the Homeless Empowerment Program since July of 2017, and before that, she served as that organization's Director of Development, Director of Marketing, and Marketing Coordinator. Ashley is a past Achievements Director on the Board of Directors for Add to Tampa Bay, a national club for young professionals in the advertising industry. She also currently serves as a member of the Advisory Council for the Clearwater Chamber's Achieve Hers, and is a member on the Homeless Leadership Board's Providers Council. She joins us this evening on the Veterans News Hour to tell us about the services and resources of the Homeless Empowerment Program and to share her insights about how we can successfully address the problem of homelessness. So let's welcome Ashley Lowry to the show. Good evening, Ashley. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's our privilege. Ashley, let me begin by asking you to describe for us what the Homeless Empowerment Program is and where it's located.
Sure. So HEP, or the Homeless Empowerment Program, is a social services agency which provides housing and support services for men, women, children, and a large portion of our campus is made up of veterans. So we are located in Clearwater, Florida, and our campus expands about eight acres in the neighborhood where we're at.
That's a fairly large campus, and I've personally been there myself on a number of occasions, really impressed with it. Now, on those 8 acres, Ashley, could you describe for our listeners really what the different buildings are like, the different parts of the campus, just the different resources that are there?
Sure. So we offer three different stages of housing. We provide emergency shelter, transitional housing, and permanent supportive housing. So the idea is to move individuals through each phase of housing until they're to the point where they're ready to be independent in the community. Kind of interspersed throughout the campus, we've got support services that are designed to break barriers of people becoming independent in the community. So some of the support services we offer are comprehensive case management. We've got a free dental and wellness clinic. We address issues of transportation, child care, workforce development, and we've got those programs kind of spread throughout the campus, but all within walking distance of the shelter that we provide.
Right. Now, I recall that you also have on the campus a thrift shop. Is that correct? And what is that about?
We do. So the thrift store actually, 100% of the proceeds of items sold from the thrift store go back into HEP programs. It generates between $250,000 and $300,000 a year for us, which is significant, but it helps us to run the campus each year. In addition to that, it also provides in-kind donations to our residents. So anybody living on HEP's campus can go to the thrift store and they can shop and get items for free. A lot of times when we have guests who come to us for help, they've got nothing but the clothes on their back. So we allow them to go to the thrift store and get clothing and shoes that they might need. If they're getting an apartment and moving off of our campus and into their own housing. They're able to get furniture and things like that as well.
I see. Now, as far as the support services, the supportive services that you alluded to earlier, in addition to the housing, so let's say that someone you know, arrives at your organization and they're suffering from any number of physical or psychological challenges. Maybe they have substance abuse or some other condition that needs help. You mentioned the dental, I believe the dental clinic. What are the kind of services, or what sort of triaging, what sort of process could a person expect if they contacted your organization?
Once they're accepted into the program, within 24 hours, all of our guests are medically and mentally assessed. So we're really getting a gauge on where that person is as far as medical care that they've had, dental care they might need, and what their mental state is. And then within 48 hours, we're working with them very intensely to get them stabilized. Because obviously being homeless is an overwhelming situation to begin with, and you can imagine how much that's compounded when somebody is facing mental and health issues as well. So that's kind of the first thing that we address. Also, within the first week of their stay with us, we're getting them a referral to our dental clinic. Our clinic has 25 volunteer dentists and hygienists who work out of it, and they actually, in 2019 alone, provided about $1 million worth of free dental care to AGP residents.
Wow.
So that's another important component of the health and wellness services that we offer.
I see. Ashley, I know that your organization serves, a large spectrum of the population, not just veterans. But since this is the Veterans News Hour, I was wondering, could you describe for us maybe specific services and resources that are offered to military veterans who may seek help at your organization?
Absolutely. So veterans do make up a large portion of the population that we serve. We serve just under 400 every day, and about 110 of those are vet-specific beds that we have available. So in addition to those three stages of housing, the emergency, transitional, and permanent, we also offer veteran-specific services. For example, we have an activities clubhouse on campus, which is just a really cool space for all of the vets who live there to gather. Of the 110 vets that we serve daily, the number of them who access the clubhouse is really a huge number. It averages between 3,000 and 4,000 check-ins per month. So that's how often that 110 number is visiting the clubhouse. So we have a gym in there. It's all Wi-Fi equipped, and there's a big entertainment center. And we actually have activities coordinators that will plan different outings and events to get our vets just involved in the community and not so focused on things that they're dealing with internally. It's just a nice positive outlet for them. We also provide our own transportation between our campus and Bay Pines VA. So it makes 4 round trips every day, and that's to get our vets to and from their doctor's appointments. In the past, we had bus passes, and they were taking the public transportation system, and it was just taking several hours to get, to a location that should be about a 30-minute drive. And they were missing appointments and things like that. So that's why we created our own shuttle system.
Wow.
We also do canine therapy. We have a lot of vet-specific counseling and mental health care that happens on our campus. And then we have case managers who are dedicated specifically to working with our vets. And the newest program that we had was actually a grant that we were awarded through the VA, and it allows for 3 case managers to work out in the community, and they actually will follow veterans who are exiting HEP's program for up to a year after they exit to make sure that they're maintaining their housing in the community, so they continue to have a resource after they leave.
Well, that's great. And I noticed from when I visited your campus, and maybe you can tell us more about it, it seemed like there was a section that were like apartments for veterans. Am I correct? And is that how it still currently is? What's that about?
Yeah. So we have two, and we actually have a section of our campus dedicated to veterans. It's all kind of in the same area, and it's really close to the clubhouse I mentioned earlier. So the two apartment buildings that are over there, one of them we call Fairburn, and it houses 40 men, typically Vietnam era, Gulf War era veterans. And that's group style housing. So we actually have 10 men per apartment, four apartments total. And it's kind of like, it's kind of set up like a college dorm, if you can imagine that. There's a common area in the middle, and then there's bedrooms around the perimeter of the common area. All of the bedrooms are double occupancy, and they each have their own bathroom. And then we have two ADA-compliant rooms in each apartment as well. So that's transitional housing, and that's funded in part through the VA. They give us a grant per diem month on that building. And then right next to it is what we call HEP West, and that's our permanent supportive housing for male and female veterans. Typically, the vet that we house there is from Iraq or Afghanistan. And those are all single-occupancy apartments. And the reason for the different style of housing is because when we were building both of those, we actually talked in great detail with the VA, and they just recommended that that for the vets coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan, they would thrive in an apartment building where they had a sense of privacy and they weren't doubled up like some of the other veterans were from different eras. But along with that, of course, they wanted us to create a space where they could get together and socialize when they wanted to, which is why the clubhouse was built. So we're very intentional with the style of housing and the style of programs that we create when we do something for our vets.
Yes, it sounds like there's been a lot of thought put into it. We've had on our show in the past representatives from organizations, one of which, for example, was one of the co-founders of a tiny home project for vets in Kansas City. And, you know, they were these very small, maybe, 300 square feet, tiny homes. But it gave the sense of individual privacy that you just mentioned that is helpful, at least to some of the veterans. Now, you said, is that considered, that's transitional housing? Does that mean they can stay there for, let's say, a year or two? Or what's the deal with that?
So the transitional housing is typically 6 months to 2 years. We only get funded for a portion of that time, and so if they extend their stay beyond that point, then HEP covers that. We do also have, HEP West is all permanent supportive, so that's longer-term housing, and that can be several years. They actually sign a yearly lease, and they can stay there as long as they are in need of our support.
I see. Now, before I ask you maybe about some bigger picture issues about homelessness and also how listeners can help your organization, let me go back and ask you about, you mentioned emergency housing, because I assume that although the campus, 8 acres, a lot of resources, a lot of buildings, et cetera, there still is finite space. And what's the difference between, let's say, emergency housing, and do you have a waiting list for any of these sorts of things?
Sure. So emergency housing is just much shorter length of stay. It's a 30 to 90 day program. They still have access to all of the support services we offer during that time, but it's more intensive and more focused on them moving on either to our transitional housing or exiting into independent housing within that period of time. So if somebody stays the full 90 days that we're allowed to keep people in that shelter and they're not ready to move on, then we'll look at moving them into our transitional housing, which provides longer-term stay. It really just depends on the individual and the amount of care and case management that they require. So we have a 100-bed emergency shelter, and out of that, about 40 of them are designated to vets. Unfortunately, we don't run a waiting list simply because the population that we're handling is quite transient. So after they leave our shelter, it's very hard to track them back down again. So our shelter is largely referral-based. We get a lot of referrals directly from the VA, And then we've got a small number of beds in that shelter that are first come, first serve. So if somebody is fortunate enough to come on a day where we've got a bed opening up like later in the afternoon, then that's how somebody would get one of those beds.
I see. And one more kind of follow-up to that. You've described the bed, the housing situation, and the support of services and care. One last, probably an obvious thing is, what about meals? Can you tell us about, what that's like, the kitchen and the meals and the dining arrangement there for people?
Yeah, so we have a commercial-grade dining hall and kitchen. We serve about 115,000 meals a year. We do breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day. Breakfast is continental, and then lunch and dinner, we've got a fresh salad bar every day, and we do a hot meat, vegetable, and starch. We're actually known for having really good food. We've got awesome culinary chefs who work there. It's really low on staff. We've got two full-time staff and one part-time staff member, and then the rest of it is volunteer-based. We've got quite a high number of our own residents who volunteer in there, and then community-based volunteers as well. And we actually, just within the past couple of years, added a large organic in-ground garden to our campus, as well as a traditional vertical garden to our campus where we're actually growing a lot of our own produce. So all of that right now is ending up on our salad bar as well.
Well, that's awesome. Two more questions, and then I'm sure Rick Hurley has a question or two for you. Here's a question for you, Ashley. What would you like our listeners to know about ways that society can do a better job in addressing the root causes of homelessness?
I think a really important thing for the community to keep in mind is that, I'm taking words from our late chairman, Bruce Fife, who was a huge advocate for the veteran population and was our chairman for 23 years, but he always used to tell people that homelessness is not the issue. It's a symptom of much larger issues that are going on. So, I think it can be very easy to look at somebody on the street and maybe assume that they're into drugs or assume that they like that lifestyle. But there are always underlying issues that are leading an individual or a family in many cases to be in that situation. So I think just kind of having a sense of the whole picture and not just what you see on the street will go a long way in us as a community trying to resolve the issue of homelessness.
Oh, well, great. Rick, any questions for Ashley?
You may have said this before, Ashley. How many men and or women do you currently have at the facility?
We house just under 400 a day. And I'd say the number probably ranges from 360 to 400, and that just depends on family size. So the three demographics that we serve are families with children, veterans, and then single men and women. So I mentioned earlier we've got 110 vets who live with us daily. We've got anywhere between 80 and 100 children who live with us on campus, and then the rest make up single men and women.
Well, and you're funded, pretty much through private donations and
we
grants?
We get a large percentage of our funding through private donations, so just individuals who are invested in the work that HEP does. And then we do get some funding from federal, state, and local government, although not a huge portion, but they certainly contribute, especially when it comes to our facilities and building and our veterans programs. They make a big difference there. And then we do get some funding from private foundations and corporations as well.
So I'm sure you probably ran these numbers, but so when you break it down, what is the cost for a homeless veteran, let's just take one veteran.
We have been working on trying to figure that number out for several years, and I think where we run into trouble is that the suite of services that any one individual takes advantage of varies drastically from person to person. So one individual, for example, they might rack up, $5,000 worth of dental care, whereas somebody else who comes in doesn't need that much care. So it really just depends. Our overall budget for the entire year is $6 million. Wow. So, and we serve around 1,200 people a year. So that kind of gives you a rough idea of the cost
So in addition to the money being donated, do you find that you'll get professional services donated too?
We do. We actually have our volunteer base is tremendous, and they do such great work. We get a lot of organizations that come out and will help us paint entire buildings so that we're not having to hire out for that. We get people who help us with our landscaping. Our campus is truly beautiful. It's not what you imagine, I think, when most of us imagine what a homeless shelter looks like. You might think it's kind of run down or not too warm and welcoming, but we really take pride in the way that our campus looks. We strive to not give our residents anything that we wouldn't eat, clothes we wouldn't wear, a bed we wouldn't ourselves sleep in. And our volunteers really help us to maintain that.
Do you find, in Florida, community service is a big part of a high school curriculum, and in fact, you need community service hours in order to graduate these days from high school. So do you get a lot of high schools to participate in your program?
We do. We're actually Bright Futures volunteer spot, so we get a lot of high schoolers who come and do their hours with us. Over the summer and during spring break, we kind of see a big influx of students coming to volunteer, but they do everything from volunteer in our thrift store to helping cook meals in the kitchen. They can work with our veterans down at the clubhouse. We've got a children's learning center where we actually provide before and after school care and a summer camp for the kids that live on campus, and so a lot of the students will volunteer down there. But they make a big difference to us, too.
That's awesome. Well, good luck to you, and thank you for being on our show.
Actually, let me ask you this. How can listeners donate to your organization or otherwise help your organization, either through in-kind donations or financial donations? And what's your website? Those are, I guess, all a bunch of questions in one. But
that's okay. So our website is www.hepempowers.org. There's a donate button that's real clear and easy to see right on the front page. It's a nice red button. We also have an events page that will talk about our upcoming community fundraisers. We do a nice golf tournament every year in October. It's actually going to be at Innisbrook on the Copperhead course this year. And 100% of the net proceeds from that go to our veterans program. So it's specifically a fundraiser for vets. As far as in-kind donations, we are always in need of non-perishable food items. And as odd as it may sound, we always need new socks and new underwear. That's something that when we get those things donated to the thrift store, we don't resell them just for sanitary reasons. So we're always in need of new socks and underwear for our residents of all shapes and sizes and gender. And in addition to that, I would just encourage anybody who's interested in getting involved with HEP to come down and take a tour and see it for yourself. We run tours Monday through Friday from 8:30 to 5 p.m., and it's just a neat way to see firsthand where your money would go, where your volunteerism would go. I think that's kind of the difference maker. When somebody actually sees what we're doing firsthand, I think it makes a big impact, and it really shows them the type of program that they'd be supporting.
I've been there a number of times, and I would fully endorse and encourage people to take you up on getting a tour and then helping as a volunteer or donating. Ashley, I know we mentioned earlier in the show that you're in Clearwater, Florida. For those that may they're in the Bay Area, the Tampa Bay Area, can you tell us more specifically where the address is and again how they can contact you to maybe sign up for a tour and get involved?
Absolutely. So our physical address is 1120 North Betty Lane in Clearwater. We're just about a half a mile north of Clearwater Country Club off of Drew Street, if you're at all familiar with the area. I'd be happy for people to email me directly if they're interested in getting involved or taking a tour. My email address is Ashley L. It's A-S-H-L-E-Y and L as in Lowry, and that's at hepempowers.org. I'm always happy to talk to people about volunteering, touring, making donations or just answering general questions that they might have about the program.
Well, super. Ashley, thank you so much for all the great work that you and your team are doing for the people of Clearwater, Pinellas County, and really the entire Tampa area. And we wish you continued success. We'd like to invite you back on our show sometime in the future at your convenience so you can keep our listeners updated on your organization's project. So thank you again for being on our show.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it, and I would love to take you up on that offer.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
Thanks so much. You too.
Well, thanks again to our special guest, Ashley Lowry, who's the president and CEO of the Homeless Empowerment Program. Really an awesome program, and which offers, as she said, emergency, transitional, and permanent supportive housing, other supportive care for those in need. And I just thought it would be a great opportunity to help publicize what they do in that organization. Rick, before we turn to the news, any thoughts?
No, other than the obvious, it's just great to see, you know, just yet another organization out there doing stuff for people in need. You know, over the years, we've had a lot of various people from all over the country on our show, and they're all doing powerful stuff to help the homeless and those who are seem to be getting left behind these days in our society. That's awesome. Good for Ashley, and great. Thank you, David, for having her on our show. That was a nice interview.
Well, thanks. Okay, I know we have a lot of news to talk about. Update our listeners about things like the Blue Water Navy Vietnam Veterans issues, but also some other news from the VA. Rick, I know you had the opportunity to attend, as I did this past Saturday, February 1st, a seminar sponsored by the Military Veterans Advocacy. We had Commander John Wells, who's the chairman of the board, on our show previously, just a couple weeks ago, and he talked about the seminar. It was also hosted by Marine veteran Brian Moyer, who talked about Agent Orange issues on Guam, and also the seminar was hosted by Susie Bellinger, who's the Special Project Director for the Blue Water Navy Vietnam Veterans Association and the Legislative Director for the Military Veterans Advocacy. Rick, what were your thoughts about the seminar? What were your impressions?
Well, when you seem to think you know a lot about a topic, and then you sit there and the experts really open your eyes, you realize, wow, how much more there is to everything that's going on with those Blue Water vets. And, I was astonished by a number of things. One of them was when, Secretary Wilkie decided he was going to stay the implementation of the federal court order and the impact that his decision had on some veterans who died in the interim. I mean, that was awful, absolutely awful. I mean, here the federal court turned around, made a decision, and instead of just stepping up to the plate and doing what you're supposed to do and comply with a court order, he decided not to, and people died in the interim, and I was kind of astonished by that. I was really enjoyed getting a lot of the diagrams. That was really helpful when you see it up there on the screen and showing you exactly where in Vietnam all this is being affected. And so it was a great seminar for those who attended. We only had a few lawyers. We had a lot of veterans, and the facts that Boyer came up with about Guam and the Agent Orange issue on Guam and how that Agent Orange is affecting Guam today and the high rate of cancers that are affecting the residents on Guam.
Right.
I think the numbers were like 6 to 7 times greater than that which exists on the mainland here in the United States. And, he talked about that high level of autism. And he implied the causal relationship between the Agent Orange and possibly autism.
Now, well, we know that Agent Orange has caused a lot of you know, effects to children of veterans who are exposed in Vietnam, as well as children in Vietnam itself, the generations that have been born and raised in Vietnam, who, unlike the American veterans who come back to the United States, they live there. It's their home. And so that's been a big issue there. But, yeah, I think I was really impressed by both of the major parts of the seminar, the first being focusing on the Navy veterans who served off the coast in Navy ships, the so-called Blue Water Navy veterans, Vietnam, during the Vietnam War, but also the part you mentioned, Rick, which was the Guam veterans and their exposure to Agent Orange. And I was really impressed with the package of information that that Brian Moyer distributed and then discussed, with some very detailed maps of Guam and different sections, and even an affidavit, notarized affidavit of a veteran attesting to specific sections where the herbicide, and I guess we probably ought to use the broader term herbicide, not just Agent Orange, because there are other non-Agent Orange herbicides which are just as toxic, that were used to essentially kill the vegetation along, for instance, pipelines, along the flight line, along fuel storage areas, along various areas on Guam. And that part I found particularly helpful, not just for general information, but actually for future use in supporting veterans that have claims there, because, like I say, you have this notarized affidavit with a map showing where spraying was done, and a lot of other good information. And beyond that, you know, to know that there's really an established group that is working these issues, just like there was there's the Blue Water Navy veterans component, and then there's the Guam survivors of Guam component. So there are a lot of resources out there. And one thing that John Wells mentioned to me before the seminar started on Saturday was his organization's plan on having these seminars around the country. This one in Tampa on Saturday was apparently the first, and I think it was, you know, very helpful, not just for the information given, but we've established more contacts and people that we can turn to as support and experts on these issues. So,
ironically enough, I went to a Super Bowl party, and at the party were at least a half a dozen Vietnam veterans. And so I had all this information on my cell phone, so I was pulling it up and I was showing these veterans, and they got a big kick out of it. I think they spent more time looking at my cell phone in Vietnam than they did watching the football game. And one of them was a Blue Water veteran, and he's like, "Oh, this is where I was," and he was pointing out and telling everybody, and you know, how far he was off the coast, and it was really interesting to kind of sit back and watch, you know, half a dozen of these men kind of look at all this information and share their own viewpoints, you know, based on their own experiences in Vietnam. And right. One was talking about Monkey Island. You know, he had been out there, and which was highly sprayed with Agent Orange. And, so yeah, that was very interesting stuff, and I have a client who we were preparing for her Board of Veteran Appeals hearing, and she started talking about what's going on physically, and she's got all these strange medical conditions other than the ones that are currently on appeal, such as PTSD, and she was on Guam for 5 years.
Wow.
And she was telling me that all these doctors that are examining her over the last year or so, 2 years, maybe even longer, I think, you know, they have no idea what's going on with her body. So we filed claims today, you know, based upon all the information that we got at the seminar. I'm thinking, you know, You know, I'm not a scientist. I'm not a doctor. But clearly the doctors can't figure out what's going on with her medically and what the cause is. And then when I Googled a lot of these different diseases that she had, one of the causes for some of these diseases was environmental. Fibromyalgia, for instance, can be an environmental causation. So who knows, you know? So we at least put it in there and see where it goes.
Yeah, it's good to at least, as you say, start the process, and as more information becomes available. But even with the information that is available, like the information they give out in the seminar, that there's a lot of documentation out there about the use of herbicides in Guam. But and there's other places as well. This is really just the tip of the iceberg. You know, there are places in the United States where Agent Orange was used, stored, and beyond that, you have other environmental toxic exposure like Camp Lejeune, but there are many other installations around the country with similar but just not as well-known contamination issues. So,
yeah, I always say my personal opinion about Camp Lejeune is it's the poster child for those environmental water contamination issues, and if the lid blows up on Camp Lejeune, then I think the number is like another 132 bases around the country could then come into play. So my personal opinion is that if the government's trying to keep a lid on Camp Lejeune and not have it blow up in their face,
yeah,
because then it could be. And this reminds me of something else that John Wells said, which I thought was really appropriate when he said that the federal court system is not concerned with the money. Remember that?
The VA is, though.
and the VA is, but the federal, and that's why veterans, if you're listening, you got to file your cases, and even if the VA denies you, you've got to get the case into the federal court system because they're not concerned about the money, they're concerned about the veteran. They're going to do the right thing by the veteran and kick it back and make the VA do what they should have done the first go-around. So I thought that was nice to hear coming from John, because, you know, he's got boots on the ground when it comes to that issue, the blue water vet. So he's up in D.C. all the time.
Yeah, he's described on some of our previous shows, and he alluded to it on Saturday, too, is that, you know, Congress has, among other factors on their legislation, is this pay-as-you-go to try to keep federal spending somewhere within, you know, shouting distance of sanity. And that's presented some limitations. But we know on the Camp Lejeune side, for instance, that's not been a problem. It's very complicated, far beyond my level of knowledge. But someone like John Wells has had to deal with that because he's done extensive lobbying up in Washington for this issue. So for those that are listening and if they're interested in more of these toxic exposure issues, Military Veterans Advocacy Organization is an excellent resource. Within that organization, they work with Blue Water Navy veterans, another organization called Survivors of Guam, and even another organization which is broader than just Vietnam, which is Veterans of Southeast Asia, because as we know that Agent Orange was used at some of the other in some of the other countries, like Thailand, for instance, the rules are for veterans claiming Agent Orange exposure in Thailand they're much more restricted rules than they are for the simple boots on the ground rule for Vietnam. It's an issue we'll continue. I'm sure, you know, having John Wells on the show again in the future will be helpful. Before we move on to any other topics, Rick, anything further you want to add about Agent Orange or toxic exposure?
No. We'll just keep on fighting it. That's all we can do. And
yep.
You know, just want to just make sure whatever veterans are listening tonight, and you've got these issues, don't give up. I mean, I just started a claim for an 83-year-old veteran who's been service. He was in Vietnam in 1963. He's been service-connected for diabetes. and he's got other issues now, and he's, you know, he's not doing that well, but he's still alive, and he's got a wife, and he wants to make sure that he gets service-connected for whatever he can get service-connected for not only for himself, but if he should die of a service-connected disability, then the benefits that might then flow to his wife. So, you know, you veterans, don't ever give up. Don't ever think you're too old to file a claim, especially if you have a wife who might survive you. So, anyway, let's move on, David.
Yeah, well, one of our guests, I want to mention that our guest next week will be Lauren Price, who is the co-founder of an organization called Veteran Warrior. She's been on our show before to talk about another environmental exposure issue, and that's specifically dealing with the open-air burn pits that were commonly used in Iraq and Afghanistan and some other installate bases and countries in the Middle East and Africa, but particularly Iraq and Afghanistan. And she's going to be on our show next week to update us on that issue and some of the legislation that's kicking around in Congress. There have been various proposals introduced, and quite frankly, I think there's a lot of room for some improvement, progress, and with the goal, I think, it ought to be that they have a presumptive list like they do for Agent Orange, but that they have that for conditions which the science, the medical data, the research already exists to show that, that these are toxic substances, and to acknowledge that veterans stationed in various places were exposed to this. So we'll see what Lauren Price can tell us next week on the open air burn pit issue. As far as some other news this week, one that I've mentioned in the past but I think is worth repeating is a major change in the law that affects, that benefits survivors, widows, widowers of service members who had served a career and were receiving a military pension, and as part of that had been participating in what's called the Survivor Benefit Plan. As they know, probably through the personal financial hardship, is that for years, for decades, in the legislation, in the law, there's been a rule that says that the survivors cannot receive Survivor Benefit Plan and Dependency Indemnity Compensation in the full amount. In other words, there's an offset. Well, Congress, after years of complaints that this was essentially a widow's tax, in December, Congress passed and the President signed into law an amendment that's part of the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2020. And it's phasing out this offset, which is great news. But unfortunately, Congress isn't making it simple. Rather than just eliminating the offset outright, they're phasing it in over the next several years. So in this calendar year that we're in now, 2020, the offset is still going to continue. For 2021, the offset is being reduced by one-third. In 2022, it's being reduced by two-thirds. And in 2023, the offset will be totally eliminated, which means, in plain language, that a survivor could then receive the full Survivor Benefit Plan annuity and the full amount of dependency indemnity compensation, which is typically awarded when the veteran dies from a service-connected disability. There are some other situations, too. But it's a really important change in the law, so if you know anyone that is receiving a Survivor Benefit Plan and dependency indemnity compensation, or should be, they can get more information from Defense Finance and Accounting Service website, which is DFAS.mil, and look under their retired military section. Of course, you can give us a call, too, about that, and be happy to get you the information or steer you in the right direction. So it's a really important change in the law. Rick, before we go to our closing tonight on coaching and care, anything else you'd like to discuss? Any other news you have.
No. One thing I'd want to tell veterans about, you've heard this on the show before, and Dave and I, we've talked about it ad nauseum. You know, the VA is basically, you know, this new system is kicking the can down the road, and by that I mean they're taking your claims, and they're denying your claims, and then forcing you essentially up to the Board of Veteran Appeals, which you can imagine, and I've got currently pending a lot of cases at the Board of Veteran Appeals waiting to be heard. And just today, I was one of my clients inquired about, you know, I think we've been waiting now about 9 months for the BVA. And so I sent an email up to my contact at the BVA, and she got back to me, and she gave me a number, you know, basically where he stands, and it's, you know, probably at least another 4, 5, 6 months down the road. But she commented in her email that this is the longest backlog that the BVA has ever had. And it's clearly, as she said, caused by the fact that they're getting more cases sent up as a result of the VA basically not doing their job.
Was this a legacy under the old system or under the new system?
New system.
Because I'm wondering right now what the latest numbers are for the people that have appealed to the BVA under the legacy system. Because I've got a few clients that are still under the old system, some under the new system, and I'm just wondering how much longer it's going to be. You know, the general guidance that I've read and heard is that under the new system, you know, there's three lanes that the BVA has set up. The first lane is just basically a record based on the existing record. You're not asking for a hearing. You're not saying you need to submit any more information. It's based simply on the record. And, you know, that's supposed to be the fastest lane. But, of course, by choosing that lane, you're giving up the opportunity to submit more information at that point. And the other lane, the second lane, would be that you want to submit information, but not requesting a hearing. And from what I've heard and read, the time frame for that is really kind of no sooner than about a year that you're going to get a decision, which suggests to me that the third lane, we could be stuck in the same time frame that we saw for years, which was literally waiting a couple years or longer for someone that wants the most thorough lane, which is they have information they want to submit, they want to submit it at a hearing, and in addition to the hearing, under the new rules, they get 90 days after the hearing to submit even more information, which is important because, you know, sometimes at the hearing it becomes apparent, maybe through what the judge says or otherwise, that there might be some specific things that the judge wants to see, and you got 3 months to see if you can develop that evidence, which is helpful. But again, you're waiting. It could be years, knowing also that a victory at the BVA sometimes is not an outright grant of the claim. Sometimes the most you can realistically get is the famous remand, where they note that the regional office messed up and they're sending it back for corrective action, maybe a new medical exam or a new medical opinion, or to apply the law correctly, or maybe all of the above. So it's the new system still requires a lot of patience.
It certainly does, and I got another one. Just to give the flavor of what happens in my office on a regular basis, on a daily basis. You know, I'm inquiring, you know, on a case that was remanded, and there's a woman that I was given her name and told she was the guru for the VA for the VA's remand cases. And she's up in Philadelphia. Well, she sent me an email today, and she said, and the client's here in Florida, and she said, we don't handle that one. That's in the Fargo regional office. We're not handling that one. And I said, well, I thought you were the guru. I thought you were in charge of all the remand. And she backed off real fast. Well, not if it's, outside my jurisdiction, which, again, that's not necessarily accurate because she has been handling some of the cases that I have that were outside of her jurisdiction. But when she told me that now this remand's coming out of Fargo, and remember what I just said, the client is here in Claremont, Florida, which is near Orlando. So,
well, did the Philadelphia VA employee say what her, quote, jurisdiction was? Was it a geographic, or was it by subject matter? You know, like Louisville handles Camp Lejeune. Was this a widow's pension thing that Philadelphia handles typically?
No, it's geographic. It's not a widow's pension. No, it's just... And now she's saying it's a geographical issue. So I said, so in other words, from now on, when I'm trying to figure out what's happening on a remand for one of my clients, I can't just assume that you're going to have all the information on it, which, it leads me to believe that she still does have all the information on it because she knew the case was out in Fargo.
So she well, I hope she'll at least refer you to the person in Fargo.
Yeah, and to her credit, she gave me two names of people in the Fargo Regional Office, which I'm going to inquire with tomorrow. But, you know, here's another example of, a case of veterans who's in Claremont, Florida, just near, not far from Orlando, so basically one town away from Orlando, and his case is sitting in Fargo. Another thing I just want to add, over the weekend I was on the phone with one of my contacts at the VA in St. Pete, and we're working on some cases, and we resolved a couple. And, I really gave him a hard time about just my experiences in the last month dealing with the VA. And he said, as I have been saying, the problem today is the national queue. And by that I mean is all cases in the VA sit in the national queue so that any decision review officer from anywhere in the United States can, when they're going through the national queue, can pull down a case, no matter where that case is, original jurisdiction, could be Florida, could be Georgia, could be Hawaii, and the decision review officer could be in Boise and work on that case. And do something piecemeal, just that moment to work on that case, and then does something, sends out a letter to the veteran and the lawyer, and says, "This is what needs to happen on that on the case at this point." Well, 2 months later, that same case could now be looked at by somebody in New Hampshire, and they might pull something out and do something. So what I'm saying is, By doing that, you cannot. There's no way you're going to have consistency with the handling of that file. You're going to have too many, too many cooks in the kitchen, and you're just not going to get a consistent decision. And our guy down there at St. Pete said that's a huge problem because it's causing a problem for other decision review officers around the country, especially those like the one in St. Pete, who is trying to resolve a lot of his cases, and then one of his cases ends up being looked at by somebody outside of his jurisdiction, and then 2 months later he goes back to his case again. Well, someone's already looked at his case.
Yeah, it's
so
a mess.
You got all these. It's chaotic.
Yeah, Rick, we're about out of time. We got about a minute and a half left. If you want to do a quick summary of the coaching and the care, and so we'll wrap up for tonight.
Sure. Our coaching and the care program, which helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching and the care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. Give the program a call at 1-888-623-7458. Its hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Again, the coaching and the care number, it's toll-free, is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I would like to once again remind listeners, if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs also has the Veterans Crisis Line to help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they did not get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line can help. Call that number at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
Well, it's time for us to go for this evening. Thank you all for listening. I'd like to thank our producer, PBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. Hope you'll tune in next week. Our special guest, Lauren Price, of the group called Veteran Warriors, will be here 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 Central, 5 Mountain, and 4 p.m. PBS Radio, Station 1. Until then, have a great week.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.